Today we are in part three of our study, singleness, marriage, divorce, and remarriage, and unfortunately it's not going to be the last one. I think the one we're looking at today is the toughest one. I know that's tough to imagine, seeing the topics that we've covered already. I know that for some of us, it's been tough. I think personally, today is the toughest. It takes a little bit of a shift today. We've spent 2 weeks talking mainly about divorce and remarriage for the Christian. And it has not been easy ground to cover. Today is not going to be easier. So just keep that in mind. Those of you who feel like none of this applies to you, bear with us, because I do know there are some of us in here that need to hear this. And even if that weren't true, even if there was not a single person in here that I felt like these things applied to, I would still want to teach them, because there are people listening online from all over the place. And these are very important subjects. It's not your standard Sunday morning evangelistic sermon. It's a teaching that gets down into the nitty-gritty of things like singleness and marriage. And those are going to be our two major topics today. We're moving away from the topics of divorce and remarriage. Today, we're looking at singleness and marriage. And what we're going to find in this first section of 1 Corinthians 7, which will be verses 1 through 7, that's all we're going to cover today. And what we're going to find here is biblical, practical wisdom and guidelines for you. First of all, to make sure that you find the right status for you, whether that's singleness or marriage. And then secondly, to give you wise biblical counsel on how to stay in that status that God called you to and do so in a fulfilling, rewarding, satisfying, faithful way. So turn with me, if you would. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. Now, concerning the things of which you wrote to me. Now, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, the reason that Paul writes this chapter on the topics that he does, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, is because the church at Corinth had written to him with a bunch of questions about singleness, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. How do I know that? Well, we don't have that original letter that was sent to Paul. We have that nowhere in our historical record. So how do I know those are the things that they wrote, the Church of Corinth, to Paul? It's simply from reading Paul's answers that he's giving and based on the answers, surmising the questions. It's pretty easy to do, right? And here's the first question that Paul is answering. Paul says, verse 1, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, it's a difficult, clunky translation here, so let me read it to you in two other translations. First of all, the English Standard Version gives us an improvement upon this translation. It says in the English Standard Version, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. That's a good translation. Here's a better one. It's from the Wiest translation. You may have never heard of that one, but a great translation of this verse. Wiest says this, it is good for a man to remain strictly celibate. For certain, that is what Paul is trying to say here in verse 1. Which means that the first question went something like this. Paul, is there anything wrong with the person who lives a single and celibate lifestyle? Why might they have to ask that question? Real simple. God's design for marriage. God's design for marriage is a man and a woman married for life, right? We've covered that well. Knowing that God created man and then said it's not good for man to be alone, one might assume that for a person to live a single and celibate lifestyle, that it is somehow morally or spiritually inferior to a person who marries and lives a married life in Christ, right? So that's the sort of thing that Paul is dealing with right from the start. Paul is saying that The single and celibate lifestyle is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. From a societal standpoint, it would not be a good idea if everyone chose this lifestyle, single and celibate. What would happen? The human race completely wiped out within a generation. Because we know God's design, his you know, the norm for all of this is that a man find a woman, get married, have kids, therefore populating the earth. From a societal standpoint, it is an inferior position to take. But from a spiritual standpoint, Paul is going to let us know in great detail, there's nothing inferior spiritually about a person that chooses to live a single and celibate lifestyle. So he starts off by, you know, correcting those that would come against the single celibate person as if there's something wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a good thing in the body of Christ. And I know we're all going to shake our heads real quick at that and say, yeah, well, of course, we all know that. But I think it still bears repeating and teaching based upon how I've seen some Christians respond to, well, let me say this, how I've seen Christian married people respond to Christian single people. I've heard crazy things in my lifetime. I've heard Christian married people come up to a Christian single person and say, how old are you? What? 27? And you've never married? What's wrong with you? You're not like funny or something, are you? I mean, come on, at 27, you should be married. You know what I'm talking about? How Christian people tend to pressure single people into getting married as if that is the morally and spiritually superior position. Paul says, first off, that is not the case. There is nothing morally or spiritually superior about that position. Paul says to those people, back off. Don't pressure the single people, the celibate people. Don't pressure them into marriage. Verse 2. Though the single and celibate lifestyle is good, verse 2, nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, and we know what that word is by now, don't we? Porneia in the Greek, from which we get our English word pornography. We know that it means sexual immorality or sexual sin. We know that the King James Version translates it as fornication. Paul says, because of porneia, because of fornication, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. So according to Paul, though the single celibate lifestyle is a good thing or can be a good thing, Paul realizes not all are going to be able to handle that kind of lifestyle. In fact, most people are going to be discovering the need to be married because that is by far the norm. And if a person has the desire to be married and you pressure them to stay in a single and celibate lifestyle, what's going to happen is you're going to be pressuring them to remain in a single state, which is going to cause them to struggle with lust and likely commit sexual sins. Paul says, if you have a husband or wife, it's going to help with that issue. Makes sense. We see here that Paul has reasserted our fellowship stance on the definition of what the word fornication means. If there was ever a doubt that some of those other groups out there that define the word fornication differently, if there was a doubt that perhaps they were right, Paul just settled it. Here's what he said in my own words. He said, to avoid sexual sins, get married, and then sex within that marriage will not be a sin. Now, a word of caution here, a word of just practicality. Paul is not suggesting that we go get married just to avoid committing sexual sins. First of all, that is not given as a proof, as a definite. It's not a given thing. Some people get married and that does not solve the tendency, the propensity to commit sexual sin. So first of all, it doesn't work all the time. But second of all, marriage may open up a whole new set of problems for that person. And third of all, if this were the only reason Paul was given us to get married, this would be a lousy solo reason all by itself. So Paul is not suggesting that you run out there and marry the first thing that looks at you, the first thing that breathes, the first thing that's single. You know, you're a Christian, and I am too. You're cute, and I'll do. Sexual sin is really scary. We're single, let's marry. No, that's not what Paul was saying. Don't rush out and do this just because you're struggling with sexual sin. You know, you balance all the Bible together. It just simply means what Paul is telling us here is that if you're struggling with sexual sin prior to marriage, that is telling you something. It's telling you that you are best suited for a married lifestyle. And if you'll get into a married lifestyle eventually, as the Lord brings that person to you, apply all the other verses we know. Once you find a believer, once the Lord brings that person to you and you are faithful within that marriage relationship, then what Paul is saying, that gives you the best chance of fulfilling those desires that are in your heart. Obviously, the desires for intimacy and, of course, also as well, sexual intimacy with a partner. Now, once you do get married, verse 3, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. Now, when Paul speaks about affection here, he's not just talking about making sure you call your spouse babe or bae. He's not talking about, you know, the hug, the once a day mandatory hug for the marriage. He's talking about the full gamut of affection, which includes, of course, sexual intimacy within the marriage. And because of Paul's topic, what Paul is doing is predominantly referring to the sex life between two married people. If you don't believe me, just keep reading. That is very clearly the context of what Paul is referring to. Now, I know this is an uncomfortable topic to be speaking about in church. And if you go back a handful of years, you'd probably find out that pastors never really talked about this issue at all. You know, they picked their messages topically. So no one woke up one morning from the pastor's study, got in there and decided, I'm gonna teach 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 through 7. Not many people do that. It's a tough topic to hear, and pastors usually try to avoid it. That's why I like what we're doing. We go chapter by chapter, verse by verse. We let topics come up naturally and scripturally. So here we are, all because of Luke 16, 18. Do you believe that? One verse launched us into all this, but here we are. And I think it's unfortunate that pastors have avoided this topic, because you know who doesn't avoid this topic? The world. You know who doesn't avoid this topic? Your kids' school friends. So unfortunately, for many years, many of us were taught sex by the world, by the school system, by our friends. That's very unfortunate that it wasn't the church teaching us about sex and the proper place for it, the proper use for it, and the blessing of it. It's very unfortunate. It shouldn't be that way at all. And of course, now it's not an anchored fellowship because we're talking about it. We must remember that sex within marriage, sex is God made, God designed, and God given. C.S. Lewis was right when he said, pleasure was the Lord's invention, not the devil's. But because this is sex, because this is a design, a creation, a development of God, that also means that it must be God governed. Everything that's God designed is God governed. And what is sin or what is perversion? It is working outside the guidelines and the boundaries that God sets up for everything that He created. Now, obviously, God set up the boundaries for sex to be only between two partners that are married. And anytime we get outside of that definition of sex, it becomes not a good thing. It becomes a perversion of God's design. But God's design for sex is beautiful, it's wonderful, and it's not something that we should be ashamed of. Now, you see the word do here. Do you know what the word do means? It means do. When your bills are due, you're supposed to pay up. And when you don't pay up on your bills are now overdue. And the problem with many Christian marriages and why they don't succeed is because in this specific area of intimacy, the spouses are overdue. That word due tells us, now I know Mark would spell it D-E-W. We all spell it right, D-U-E. That word due tells us that, well, actually, it's kind of like a new revelation about sex within marriage. We probably quickly understand that it is a pleasure and a privilege. And now we've just found out from the Apostle Paul that it is also a duty or an obligation within the marriage. Verse 4. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Now, back up. There's a bigger spiritual truth here. I see some giggling out there already. People like to use this one as weapons in their marriage. I haven't tried it yet. There's a bigger truth here. Paul's not giving us the highest truth. The highest truth is that spiritually, God is in charge of your bodies. Your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. He's in charge. That's true spiritually, but sexually, the truth is, you're not in charge of your own body, husband. Wife, you're not in charge of your own body either. Now, we have to be careful with this. We have to use a little bit of common sense, don't we? Because we understand how this could be twisted and misused. This verse is not meant to encourage a partner to coerce or force sex against their spouse's will. It is meant to encourage mutuality. That's the meaning of the verse. It's meant to encourage mutuality. What it's telling you, in short, is that the man who probably thinks he has the most rights within the sex life, but God would say that's not the case. Man, you don't have the rights. You're not in charge of this thing, and vice versa, the woman as well. You're not in charge of this thing either, so it's a mutual thing. Husbands, it's not all about you. Wives, it's not all about you. So we understand the meaning that sex is to be mutually pleasing and mutually agreed upon. So one person does not set all the rules within the intimate relationship of a marriage. Verse 5. Oh, it gets better. Verse 5. Do not deprive one another sexually, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. Okay, we covered the general rule. The general rule is be regular and consistent in your marital sex life. But again, we're going to apply some common sense to this. We need to apply some common sense to the topic because there are some things that might cause us to find our way around some of this. For example, health issues, age, and other factors, other circumstances bring complexities that must be considered between the spouses. So you work those issues out between the two of you. Let there be agreement. Let there be mutuality. But in general, don't withhold sex from your spouse. Be regular and seek to keep them satisfied. But with that said, Paul did give us a very acceptable spiritual exception to that rule. Paul said, here's the deal. If you're going to abstain from sex within the marriage, it needs to be three things. Number one, it needs to be temporary, not permanent. It needs to be temporary. It needs to be mutually agreed upon, number two. And number three, it needs to be for spiritual purposes. All right? So any break from the regular sex life within the couple, this is Paul's desire that it would be for three reasons. Temporary, or that it would be three things. Temporary, mutually agreed upon, and for spiritual purposes. So it is essentially fasting sex while you fast food. Now, we covered our fasting topic one Sunday morning long ago, and this was outside of the scope of that topic of fasting. But anyone who has fasted for an extended period of time is going to say, well, this only makes sense. Because when you're fasting and you're not eating and you have no energy and you can barely move, the last thing you want to do is have sex with your partner. That's all that Paul is saying here. That is a good reason for you to abstain from a regular, consistent sex life within the marriage. Nothing else. Well, obviously, except for the things that I mentioned, things like health issues and unique concerns. But in general, don't let anything else stop you from being regular. So get this. Answer this question. How long is it okay for me to abstain from sex with my spouse? Just in general, other factors aside, how long is it okay for me to abstain from sex with my spouse? The answer, according to Paul, would be this: for however long you can fast. And some might say, well, I can only fast for 3 days. Well, there's your answer. That's how long you can abstain from sex within the marriage. For 3 days while you're fasting food. Some might say, Arlen, I can only go like one meal, like 5 hours. Well, there's your answer. You shouldn't abstain at all. So be regular, be consistent. Reading on, he says, once you have come out of that temporary abstinence within the marriage relationship, reading on in verse 5, he says this, come together again sexually so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. All right, the point is well taken, easily accessible. Regularity lessens the possibility of temptation. And unfortunately, many married couples don't take Paul's counsel all that seriously here. And they become inconsistent in their marital obligation, and they don't think any harm is going to come to the marriage. But if we just started scanning the statistics, I think we'd find out that one of the most common reasons for divorce is because there was a spouse within the marriage that was withholding the obligation, yes, don't be afraid to say it, the responsibility, the obligation to satisfy their partner's sexual needs. And as a result, that partner ran out on them and found it somewhere else. It's a terrible thing. It shouldn't happen. But Paul says you can prevent that just by being regular. So married people, take this seriously. Talk it out, come to mutual terms, and use what you know about this. Use sex as a weapon to strengthen your marriage. Verse 6. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. In other words, Paul is saying, I'm not commanding you to get married. I'm not saying you have to get married. Paul says, this is a concession. I would prefer it if you didn't get married. I'm not telling you you have to get married. I'm conceding to the fact that most people are going to need to get married to help contain those sexual desires, to be able to fulfill them and express them. And Paul says, verse 7, for I wish that all men were even as myself. Which would be what? What was Paul? What was his status? He was living a single and celibate lifestyle. Now, I don't know why this popped into my head, but just right off the top of my head, it means we have to rethink some things. Paul is an elder of the church. Anyone filling a position like this, like apostle or pastor, that's their position, but their person has to be an elder, and there are qualifications for an elder. One of those qualifications is that they be a husband of one wife. And churches take that and they misunderstand it, and they therefore exclude many good pastors, many good candidates from the position, because they say one of two things. Number one, he's not married. He's single. Sorry, can't be an elder, can't be a pastor, can't be an apostle. You're not married. You have to be married. And they say, you're excluded because you're not married. Well, Paul was not married, and he is an apostle in the church. So you understand what was being said there. That passage was spoken to a bunch of people that were struggling with polygamy. And all that requirement for an elder was saying, you can't be married to multiple wives. You have to be the husband of one wife. And it doesn't work the other way either. Well, you're not eligible to be a pastor. You're not eligible to fill a ministry position in our church because you have to be the husband of one wife. And you divorced. You're on your second wife. Well, the question would be, well, yeah, maybe, but how many wives do I have? I have one wife. That meets the biblical command. So I think we understand that. Paul was not married when he wrote this. He was single and singularly devoted to God, and he loved that lifestyle. He didn't want to trade it for anything. You're going to see that this week and next week. He felt like that was the most advantageous position for a person that really wanted to get serious with the Lord. Because here's an example. Every night when the married person is thinking about fulfilling their marital obligation with their spouse, the single celibate person can be in prayer and seeking. And Paul's going to make that case. Hey, if you're married, you got to make your wife happy. Husband, you got to please your wife. You got to be concerned about the things that make her happy. Same with the wife. But if you're single, if you're celibate, you don't have any of that concern. It's just you and the Lord full on all the time. It's an advantageous position. So Paul loved it, and that's how he did his ministry. But does that mean that Paul was never married? I think you know where I stand on this one. I firmly believe that the Apostle Paul at one time was married, and I think that the Apostle Paul was either widowed or divorced, and most people do believe that for multiple reasons. Number one, the first most obvious reason is just read Paul's counsel to married people. Just read it. Not just here in 1 Corinthians 7. Read all of Paul's words to married people. And when you read his counsel, I think you're going to understand that's not something Paul got out of a book. He has deep insight and knowledge into the marriage relationship. And I don't think he got that from a rabbi. I think he got that from personal experience. So that's number one. Just by reading the content of Paul's writing, you know how people are. You think the early church would have gone for this if Paul, who had never been married, was giving them marriage counsel? It's tough for a single person to give a married person counsel, isn't it? They've never experienced it. They have no idea what they're talking about. They maybe learned the information, but they've never had the experience, and it's just tough to do. So that's a strong case for Paul having been married at one point and now being either widowed or divorced. The other major reason is because we have in extra biblical resources, historical accounts, we have a general agreement that Paul at one time was married. Now, where the problem comes in is that those sources, like the writings of the early church fathers and whatnot, some of those historical records we have, though they agree that Paul was at one time married, they don't agree as to the reason why he wasn't married. They can't agree on what led Paul to eventually be in this single and celibate status. The first source gives us this explanation that Paul was married and that his wife died and Paul was a widower and chose not to remarry. That is a strong possibility. The second reason we're given is that Paul was married, and when Paul began his itinerant Christian ministry, that is when he began traveling to do ministry, that things weren't working between him and his wife and they divorced, and Paul parted with her to go on and work in Christian ministry. Now, you know that does not fit the character of Paul, and it doesn't fit what Paul teaches us about marriage and divorce in 1 Corinthians 7. So I just strike that one out as a possibility. The third possibility, the third source, which I feel has the most credence, is is this understanding that Paul was married at one time, and then Paul converted to Christianity in Acts chapter 9. And when that happened, his wife did not convert to Christianity. She chose to remain in Judaism. And as a result, his wife divorced him. One of the sources tell us that, and I think that has the strongest possibility because of what we see in the scriptures. Here's a third reason. Third strong reason is this. This seals the deal for me. Paul was a member of the Sanhedrin. You can see this by reading Acts chapter 7, verse 38, I believe it is, and then Acts chapter 8, verse 1. You'll see that Paul was a member of the Sanhedrin. And the Jewish writing, the Talmud, tells us that it was a requirement for a man that would be a part of the Sanhedrin that he must be married. That's not surprising. I don't know if you knew this or not, but many of the Jews at the time did not even believe a single unmarried man could go to heaven. You know, they went back to Genesis 2 and they felt like God's plan was for a man to find a wife, get married and have kids and procreate and reap and populate the earth. So if you weren't doing that, you were missing God's role for you and you couldn't make it to heaven. So of course, one of the rules for being a member of the Sanhedrin is that you must be married. So what happened? I think what happened was Paul got converted to Christianity. His wife did not, and she divorced him. Because if you read chapter 7 of Acts, if you read chapter 8 of Acts, Paul had to be married at that time as a member of the Sanhedrin overseeing the stoning of Stephen. He had to be a Sanhedrin member at that point. He had to be married at that point. And then suddenly, shortly after Acts 9, his conversion experience, things are different. And in his writings, we find out he's single and celibate. So I think that is the likely thing that happened. Here's what I will add to that. We do know that whatever it was that caused Paul to end up being single, divorced, or widowed, whatever it was, Paul believed that he had the right to remarry. And he says there in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 5, he says it straight up. He says, we have, meaning himself too, we have the right to take along in the ministry a believing wife. In other words, Paul says, if I wanted to be married and travel in itinerant ministry with my wife, I have that right. I'm free to do so. All right, so Paul saw a great advantage to the single and celibate lifestyle. Paul is recommending that lifestyle to all, but reading on, verse 7, Paul says, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. Now, it's interesting that Paul would use the word gift here. Paul says that the single celibate lifestyle is a gift from God. Paul says that the married lifestyle is a gift from God. Which means that neither celibacy nor marriage in and of itself is the superior or more spiritual status to be in. That's the only thing that can mean, right? It's pretty obvious this was one of their questions there in the church at Corinth. They want to know, what's more spiritual? Paul, I'm married and I'm a Christian now. Would I be more spiritual? Would it be a more godly thing for me to divorce and be singularly devoted to Christ? Or, Paul, I'm single, but I see Genesis 2, and I want to be godly, and I want to take the superior position. Paul, would it be better? Would it be superior? Would it be more spiritual for me to find a spouse and then live within the marriage relationship? So Paul settles that by essentially telling us, both of them are a gifting, and the only thing that makes one of those positions, one of those statuses superior to the other, is that the individual understand what their calling and gifting is, and then live within that calling and gifting. If you are called and gifted to be married, then you are going to be at your spiritual best when you find a good spouse that'll support that. If you are called and gifted to live a single celibate lifestyle, then you are going to be at your spiritual best when you are living faithfully in that single and celibate lifestyle. Paul tells us that that singleness has spiritual advantages. But what Paul is letting us know by verse 7 is that if you are called and gifted to be married, then the single celibate lifestyle is going to have nothing but disadvantages for you. It works both ways. Jesus said this very thing in Matthew chapter 19, verses 10 through 12. Now, when we studied it last week, we went up to verse 9, and we didn't go any further. Maybe verse 8. I think it was verse 8. And we didn't go any further with that. Jesus gave his explanation as to, you know, where and when and how a person could divorce and remarry. And because Jesus only gave that one explanation, his disciples, not the Pharisees, remember the Pharisees asked the question, but his disciples afterwards said, well, Lord, then if that's the case, keep in mind, this is the 12. This is his disciples. His disciples said, Lord, if that's the case, if that's the only reason we can dump our wives, then it would probably be better if we didn't marry. Well, then in Matthew 19, 10 through 12, Jesus launches into a follow-up about that. And Jesus says the same things that Paul is saying here. Jesus says that there are some people who live a single and celibate lifestyle, some of them by choice, some of them are forced. You know, if you, like, were in charge of a harem, well, you were forced to be a eunuch. That's the word Jesus uses. You were forced to be a eunuch, if you know what I mean. You had no choice about it. And you were made so that you could not have sex. You were forced. Now, you got paid money. You got paid good money, so that was the trade-off. But you are now forced to live a single celibate lifestyle. And Jesus says there are people that do live that lifestyle for one reason or another. And Jesus said it's only for those who what? Who can receive it, Jesus said. And Jesus said it's only for those to whom it has been given or gifted. So Jesus and Paul confirm the same thing. A person that is called and gifted, a person that has the desires to be married, they are not going to be able to successfully live a single and celibate lifestyle, which means that according to Jesus and Paul, that wacky idea within the Catholic Church that their priest must be celibate, we come to find out that is exactly contrary to what they both teach in the Bible, Jesus and Paul. And if you just look at the results, I'm not being cruel, folks. I'm not being condemning here. I'm not throwing darts. I'm just saying if you look at the results of that forcing of their priests to remain single and celibate, if you just look at the results from that, you'll understand that what Paul's saying is the truth. And there's the proof, because forcing those priests to live a single celibate lifestyle has caused what? All sorts of horrendous sexual sins. So if that's your stance as a church, that your priests or your preachers or your pastors have to be single and celibate, you better make sure you at least find the ones that are called by God and gifted by God to live that kind of lifestyle. Otherwise, fornication, big problems. So it's a special gifting and calling to be single celibate. It is not the norm. Not all can accept it because it's going to cause them to unnecessarily wrestle against lust. So remember that when you're telling divorced people not to get remarried. Now, I know there are occasions where that does need to be our counsel. But all I'm saying is when you're telling a divorced person that they can't get remarried for one reason or another, you had better make sure you know what you're talking about. Because otherwise you are forcing them, you are coercing them, you are putting them in a situation where not only are they going to commit a sin, they're probably going to commit a lifetime of sin because they're trying to live in a state that they are specifically not called by God or gifted by God for. The words of Matthew and the words of Jesus in Matthew, the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 should tell us what we need to know about this. The sexual drive is strong. And if a person is gifted to be married, they should not try to be single and celibate. Maybe some of the younger people right now are praying, Lord, please don't give me that gifting of singleness. Lord, please don't give me that call in life. Which brings up a good question. How do you know if you are gifted for the single celibate lifestyle? How do you know if you are gifted for the married lifestyle? Here's the test. Are you single? Do you want to be married? If you answer yes to that, then the answer is you are not, at least right now, gifted for the single and celibate lifestyle. Now, I'm not going to ask if you're married and want to be single. I'm not going to say that. But that's it right there. If you're single, whether single because you've never married or single because of divorce, and your desire is to get married, that is telling you that you are well suited for a marriage relationship and you're going to struggle as a single and celibate person. Do keep in mind, this may change during the course of your life. You may be single and celibate for a long time, and that may be going wonderfully for you. You may have accepted that as your calling and your gifting. And then all of a sudden, the Lord changes it up on you and you find yourself with the desires to marry. I would say pray. Pray. Start asking the Lord. Okay, Lord, if you're changing my gifting and calling, then bring me the right person and I won't refuse. I'll marry and I'll just build that marriage around you. Or if you're married and now you find yourself divorced or widowed and you think to yourself, I am totally done with women. I am totally done with men. It was my gifting and calling to be married, but after that bozo, I'm done. Well, there you go. Stick with that. That's your new calling. That's your new gifting. Stick with that, and maybe the day comes when that good-looking Christian sister bats her eyelashes at you, or that good-looking Christian man, that good-looking Christian brother changes your flat tire, and all of a sudden you feel a change of status in the air. Lord, I feel you changing my gifting and my calling. It can happen. It can happen. Here's what the Lord won't do. Hear me on this one, church. Here's what the Lord won't do. He won't change up that gifting and calling on someone that is married. So don't even try it. I'm a step ahead of you. Sweetie, honey, it's been grand, and I know divorce is going to be 10 grand. We had a good run, but sweetie, I feel the call from God to live a single lifestyle. Me and the boys are going out tonight. No, God won't do that to you. I promise you, He won't. So really, what Paul is saying, we'll close with this. Come on in. What Paul is saying, get this. This is the most important point. What Paul is saying is that when a married person is faithfully living a married life, no sin, no problem. When a single person is faithfully living a single and celibate lifestyle, no sin, no problem. Here's where the problem is. When a single person, before they're married, wants to start living like a married person. You know what I mean? They want the benefits of marriage without the commitment of marriage. That's where the problem is. The problem is when the married person decides they don't any longer want to live like a married person and they want to start living like a single person. Abstinence. Indifference. Separation. That's where the problem is. All Paul is teaching us here is this. Find out your calling and gifting in life. You can do that by just digging down into your heart and finding out what God has put in there as desires. And secondly, if you're not in that status, pray for that status. And when the Lord gets you there, live faithfully within that status. And what a great point here. I'm so glad that communion has run up against these messages. We should have got to it last week, but out of character for the pastor, he was a little long-winded last week. But it's still a perfect place because this is one area, and I mean all of these topics, this is one area where many Christians have failed the Lord. And so many Christians just head down and blowing through life without really stopping to think, Lord, have I failed you here? Have I failed you in my single life? Lord, have I failed you in my married life? Lord, have I failed you in my divorced life? Have I failed you in my remarried life? And we don't stop to think about what we've done wrong. Maybe we've been emboldened by some literal fact and won't accept the truth. I know it's easy to blame everything on the ex. Well, they did this and they did that, and Lord, I am just completely spotless and without fault. Is that right? Are you sure? What a great time for you to search your heart and see if there's sin in any of these areas. And if there is, you don't have to take that big ball of wound up mess and try to unravel it and fix it. You can start right here with the Lord in confession and repentance. What better place than at the Lord's table to take the cup of healing, the bread of salvation, and say, by faith, Lord, as I lay my sins down, as I examine myself, as I lay my sins down, Lord, by faith, I eat the bread and I drink the cup. And by faith, I accept your forgiveness. Can we have ushers come forward and pass out the elements? We're going to pray for them first. We're going to pass them out.